Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Talk Talk. I'm your host, Rob McKeefrey, and this is episode number 255. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment, as it just helps us continue to highlight the great people in our profession. Also want to thank our sponsors, and specifically InTech, for bringing this episode to you for free. I only partner with companies that I believe in, both the product and the people, and InTech, Jason, yeah, Troy and the rest of the gang are just top quality people, and they have a great product. So if you're in the market, please reach out to them. If not, the next time you see them, just let them know how much you appreciate them being a part of Iron Game Chalk Talk. This week, I'm joined by a friend of mine, Dr. Jonathan Mite. He's a visiting professor at Southern Miss. He's an assistant professor at Lindenwood, back in my neck of the woods in Missouri. And then he's also a strongman athlete. And so, man, I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to be on these types of informative podcasts for a wide group of audiences to listen and take away.
We talked a little bit about your journey, but it's a little bit different. I mean, you came at it from an athlete perspective, and then you had questions, and you chased the academic side of it, and that led to a career where now you're blending the two, you know, between practitioner and scientist. But talk a little bit about your journey, kind of Reader's Digest version, and then what are some of the motivations of what you're doing now?
So typically, like the, you know, Reader's Digest version, I mean, I typically have told, you know, my story, but I have one story that's more like an academic, you know, story. And then the other part is actually how I really got into training. So I try to, you know, do a little mix of both, but most people are not really aware. I was not very academic, you know, inclined when I was, you know, growing up through school. I was a C and D student, you know, to be honest. Got in trouble a lot in middle school, early high school, just wasn't focused, you know, lacked concentration, need a lot of help on the kind of the English and math side. And then, you know, I really kind of, you know, matriculated a little bit into early college. I at the end of my sophomore year of college, my GPA was a 1.7. And to give everybody some perspective, most entry level points in terms of college and universities these days is somewhere around a 2.5 to come into college. Mine was a 1.7. And there was a period of time where I just really wanted to drop out. I had no interest. And then I was lucky enough to meet some higher level ups, admin at the university, you know, where I was attending. So we got together, you know, formatted a plan. And from like 2002 to like 2005, fall, spring, and summer, I did nothing but coursework after coursework, and ended up graduating with my undergrad with overall, I believe, was a 3.2. And then just continued on with a master's. And really, before I even graduated undergrad, I was already thinking about graduate school. So I was somebody who went from, you know, not really caring to almost dropping out to now I'm, you know, thinking about graduate school.
Right.
And then, you know, I was coached in 2 years at WKU for baseball, softball, track, and swimming. Got my master's there. Got it done in 3 semesters. I was 23 when I finished my master's and had 2 certifications by the time I was 23. And then I wanted to go get my doctorate, actually, because I really originally wanted to coach and be a full-time coach. But I saw early on, and nobody really told me about this, but I saw early on the more flexibility and versatility that you can potentially have, you know, at the doctorate level and beyond.
Right.
So I ended up a full scholarship to University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And then it'll actually be 3 years this week, May 6th, this is Sunday, that I'll be done and defended with my doctorate. So, and that's been published. I was published last year in Journal and Strength and Conditioning Research. So, you know, because of my athletic background, being a multi-sport athlete, and then going on, you know, onto the academic side, I really wanted to be somebody that always wanted to blend both. And I saw very early on that we have a lot of, you know, professors out there that talk too much about, you know, theory and kind of pontificate too many aspects of, you know, exercise, but they're not really doing the application and implementation part. I knew very early on that I didn't want to really do that. I wanted to be something different, to be somebody different. And now, you know, many years later, it's really paid off. So I'm able to really take my experiences through, you know, competitions, multi-sport athlete, and even strongman, and take the science and really blend those into all the different types of courses, you know, that I've taught and initiate hands-on application components, you know, and really engaging, you know, with the audience. And like, I love connecting with people. And this is, you know, we talk about in this industry, well, if you're a professor, you know, or even if you're a full-time coach, well, like, you know, you're in the coaching business, you're in this business. I don't really look at it that way. To me, that's just kind of like a subcomponent. Like, we're in the people business. And our job is to really serve people and to solve people's problems. If you're a personal trainer, like, you're in the people business. You know, they come into you because they want to, you know, lose weight and feel good about themselves, et cetera. So I've been able to really do that. I've been featured in every major fitness and bodybuilding magazine out there, written for, contributed, or been interviewed, you know, for them. I was in some talks last year about doing a book for Human Kinetics, but that's kind of on the back burner, you know, for that. So I've really done a lot of good things. I've taught at over 30 conferences over the last, you know, 3-4 years. So that's something that I really am proud of. And I feel like, you know, the industry could use more of like hybrid, you know, individuals, because traditionally it's just, you know, you teach, you're all about just the research, and then you have a large disconnect, you know, with coaches. I have some graduate students in my sport nutrition class now that, you know, they love talking shop because they know that, you know, I don't just get up there and kind of talk about it. Like, I actually, you know, live it. Right. So I've been pretty lucky and fortunate to do a lot of things that I want to do. And I still want to do a lot more, you know, and it just takes time from a career and life perspective.
Yeah. I think, you know, I talk about this quite a bit. I've had a handful of guests on the show about, you know, the blending the two, you know, and you're right. I mean, you talk about opportunities now. I talk about young opportunities for young strength conditioning coaches. I think one of those that exists is to go on and continue to get your PhD early. So that way, you know, you're at a higher level. That's just a way to distinguish yourself a little bit academically, but then to turn around and use that and be one of the few with the PhD working as a practitioner, I think would be critical. And you combine that with, I mean, Brett Bartholomew and I are working on a proposal for next year's coaches conference right now about, you know, kind of some of the what ifs, like what if the strength and conditioning community, what if every staff was responsible, worked on a research study every year? You know, what would our field look like if every staff was doing that every year and just answering questions that are specific to them, but sharing that information?
You know? Absolutely. I would love to get involved with that, you know, somehow, because it's really key. And I think, you know, with full-time coaches, a lot of them take a look at the science of what it's out there, but at the same time, a lot of them feel that the information that's come out and the science stuff doesn't really apply to them. You know, and I can easily see how they would say that. Like, you know, I understand from their perspective, like I really do. I think all information is valuable, and you can take away a little bit here and there, and then you can just apply it to what you're actually doing, you know, specifically. But just to say, well, you know, I don't care about science or science is wrong, it's not the right mentality or philosophy, you know, to say, because, you know, when you have those types of attitudes, it's just like you just kind of get left behind, right? And I can tell you that it's very difficult to continue to keep up with what's going on in the industry. I mean, I have several apps that I look at several times a week and see what the newest science says about this stuff. I'm posting it online, posting it on social media. You know, I talk about it in my classes, and I think you're going to start to really see a big trend towards that. It's really kind of taken off in the last maybe 3 years or so, but you're going to continue to see a really big trend with that and really developing more hybrid, you know, individuals.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I think a lot of coaches, they get intimidated by the science because maybe they don't, they're former athletes that didn't come through it from a scientific background, or, you know, they're just, or it's timing. And, you know, that's the thing, is it's funny because the two challenges exist. The academics don't have access to the athletes, or oftentimes have the questions that are immediate of impactful questions that need to be answered for performance. They're just, like you said, just kind of thinking about, well, what's next for them? Not as working as practitioners, whereas coaches, but they're strong with obviously the statistics and the scientific process and all those things. And coaches have all the athletes that they can possibly have, you know, time to be able to conduct the research, you know, but just it could pass that off. So it's really working in conjunction with, as opposed to being two separate camps. And I think we just don't do that well enough. But for you, you know, you don't, I think in some ways, like you're, you know, not pioneering, because there's definitely people that have this, but I mean, you're in an area that there's just not a lot of people. I mean, you, Andy Galpin, Brian Mann, Mike Martino, you know, some guys that are practitioners, but also academics. You're going to bound to make some mistakes in that space. You know, what's one of the biggest mistakes you've made and how you learned from it?
Just overall in general?
Yeah, just in, you know, when you're talking about trying to blend the two disciplines together.
And this is certainly can run a parallel, like with, you know, life and stuff too. I think one of the biggest mistakes that people can make is not being open-minded enough. And I think one of the hallmark signs of actually being a good coach to a great coach, or a good professor to a great professor, is being able to really change your mind kind of on a dime's notice based upon what, you know, new evidence can come out. I mean, if something comes out on Monday that says this and something else that comes out on Friday, and then you start to develop an actual consensus of things, you know, then that's when you need to kind of shift your mindset and mentality to being open to learning different types of things. So I think that's one mistake that actually people make. I think another mistake that people make, and this is when people say, well, I want to do this, I want to do that, or I'm not where I really want to be. And there's so many different factors that go along with that. But I think one of the many factors, especially at the upper echelons, is I'm worrying about what other people say and worrying about what other people think. And feel like, you know, they're being judged by other individuals. And I think that, you know, and in the business world, and that's one of the biggest differences between like outside, you know, like business world and like academia, is that most of the time in the business world, yes, you have to deal with politics, you know, and dumb shit. But when you stop, when you worry about what other people have to think or et cetera, it decreases efficiency. And when you decrease efficiency, it decreases your speed. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Gary Vaynerchuk, and he talks about, you know, micro speed and like macro patience. So doing all the little small things like on a day-to-day basis or weekly basis, you know, and that could be, you know, dealing with students, you know, with projects, could be email stuff, you know, program design, you know, adjusting to clients and other athletes, you know, communication, those types of things. So it's micro speed, doing things at that level very well, but also having like the macro patience, because things just take time. I mean, if, you know, you're not going to buy a sports team at the age of 25 unless you have like a $50 million, you know, trust fund. you know, so those are some of the mistakes I think that people make, getting too much caught up in just the minutiae, the things that, you know, don't really matter in the big picture of things. And I think what really matters, particularly on both sides, is, you know, what are you doing to impact people? You know, are you solving people's problems? You know, you have to be an influencer, you have to bring value, those types of things that you have to really focus on, you know, and really connecting, you know, with individuals. You know, most of the time you see that, you know, the old adage is true. I mean, people don't know, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. But I will take it a step further and say, they don't care how much you care until you actually connect with them.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I think ultimately, I love Gary Vaynerchuk, I mean, as well. I think he's got some good stuff in there. And I think you have to invest in your athletes, but you have to invest in you can't be caring about too much about what the outsiders think if they don't understand what you're doing. You know, that's something that I run into quite a bit. They don't always understand. I mean, they just see me everywhere, you know, and they don't understand my motivations behind what I do. And so sometimes that can take it, be taken context. And if I wrap myself in those opinions, sometimes I wouldn't be able to make the progress that I'm making.
Yeah. And I think it's very easy for people to just go straight to the negative and the critical and the judgmental without just kind of taking a step back and kind of analyzing like what's the bigger picture. I've had a couple of people, you know, ask me like, well, you post a lot, you know, on Instagram, like, do you do anything else? I'm like, yeah, I work a full-time job. I do this other stuff. I also do writing. I do a lot of different things. And, you know, that's one of the things at least that makes me, you know, non-traditional. I'm a non-traditional, you know, professor who, you know, has a coaching background and can blend things, you know, very well together. And I think we're in the industry now, you know, and guys like you and Brett and Mike Martino and a handful of others, you know, helping to kind of set the stage, and really moving, you know, professing, you know, forward, to say, hey, like it is okay to do these other outside things as opposed to just doing one or two, you know, main types of jobs or subcomponents within that main job. I think a lot of people are afraid to really like branch out, because they're concerned of what other people, you know, might think. And I mean, I think, you know, once they start doing that, then they start to kind of, you know, between a rock and a hard place, so to speak, they go, you know, two steps forward and two steps back.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. You did your PhD work in an eccentric training. And, you know, I love, you know, I mean, I think with things like triphasic and some other, you know, applications of where eccentric training is an emphasis. I love it from a personal perspective. I did eccentric pull-ups yesterday and I'm feeling my lats right now. But the challenge with eccentrics is obviously, you know, the delayed onset muscle soreness. I mean, I think in today's age with athletics, you're kind of always in a constant state of readiness, whether or not, I mean, you're practicing year round for most sports. You're sometimes competing year round in a lot of sports. If you're at the high school level, you're competing in other sports. You know, again, you could spend hours and hours of a podcast talking about eccentrics, but let's boil it down to a couple of key takeaways of how coaches can take eccentric training and apply it to their situation without it affecting performance too much.
I think one of the biggest things everybody needs to keep in mind with eccentrics is that in terms of, you know, applying it and designing it in programs, it really works best with off-season, you know, programming and kind of really steering clear of in-season training. Because typically the biggest downside, as you just alluded to a few seconds ago, is the increases in muscle damage and muscle soreness. But just because you do eccentric training, it doesn't mean that you're constantly going to be sore. You know, just keep it simple for a second. I mean, if you do, you know, some arms at the end of your upper body workout and you're doing sets of 12 and you're only doing some eccentric reps on the last three of that set of 12, I mean, you're not going to experience so much muscle damage that you're going to be out for like 2 or 3 weeks. Right. So you actually have to do quite a bit of volume with eccentric loading to really exhibit a large increase in muscle damage, but the context, you know, everyone loves to talk about, you know, content, but you know, the context is kind of like the queen, right? You know, she runs the household in a way. Is there's so much individual variability with how people respond not only to training, but how they actually respond to aspects of, you know, muscle damage. I mean, you know, somebody could do a quick 45-minute workout, not do a whole lot of eccentric actual work and components, but be really sore. You can take another person with the same given characteristics and match them up. They do the same workout, but not really be sore. So, I mean, you can be sore by not doing any type of eccentric exercise. You can just do some type of custom training session, you know, but there's obviously adaptation that involves with that. And there's optimization that involves, you know, with that as well. So that's probably the biggest thing with eccentrics is to kind of keep it more in the off season, you know, programming. It works. It undeniably, you know, works. And there's different, you know, durations and things that you can actually use. The other thing that I would talk about with eccentrics is that most people think it's one dimensional, meaning from like a strength and conditioning perspective. So obviously it incorporates, you know, aspects of hypertrophy and strength, you know, time under tension, you know, velocity. There's various eccentric training techniques So it was like a 2-1, you know, technique, for example. So, I mean, the most simple example you can use with that is, you know, like tricep press downs, for example, you go down with two and come up with one. There's a two movement technique you can do with like a power hang power clean and like a reverse curl. But there's certain percentages and rep ranges that kind of correspond to those techniques. You know, they're super slow, they're super max. The super max technique obviously is beyond 100%, you know, 1RM. But that one in particular is a little less practical because you need a couple of spotters with you. So, you know, if you're in a weight room situation and you have some teams come in and you're doing, you know, some max effort stuff, well, I mean, think about the efficiency. I mean, somebody has to stop, you know, two people have to stop doing what they're doing and come help out the other person, you know, for super max, you know, effort, or if it's an eccentric only type of situation. So a little less practical, it works, but it's less practical, less efficient. And there's also eccentrics involved, of course, with, you know, landing mechanics and injury prevention too. I mean, we as a field talk about, you know, how it's so important to kind of teach and stick the landing first. Well, why is that important? Because you have to be able to like absorb force, right? When you think about how injuries really occur from a physiological perspective, and even from a performance or athletic perspective, is they change. I mean, you get injured during events that have a large change of direction, actually. When you're unable to absorb force because you lack your ability to decelerate, and when you lack your ability to decelerate, then you lack eccentric strength. So your ability to absorb force in order to generate force on the concentric, you know, phases, you know, decreases. So that's more of the strength and conditioning side, but you also have another side, which is really the clinical side, which is not talked about as much. But there's a tremendous amount of science using eccentrics on like ACL reconstruction and surgery, you know, osteopenia individuals, elderly individuals, you know, collagen resynthesis, you know, those types of things. It's actually used quite heavily in the clinical world. The kind of the guidelines for that, for slower duration eccentrics, like greater than 6 seconds, now you're getting the kind of the slower movements. 8 seconds, 10 seconds, and maybe up to 12. And as the individual, you know, increases performance and gets stronger, then you can actually decrease the time you spent during the eccentric phase. So that's kind of, that's a two-dimensional. And then the last one, a three-dimensional, is really more of like the movement perspective of what you do on a day-to-day basis, right? So like in just basic, you know, walking and stability, you know, gait patterns, you know, sagittal plane movements, frontal plane movements, transverse plane movements, just movement control, you know, in general, things that we do every day that we take for granted, like walking down the stairs, downhill running, those all involve components of like eccentric activity.
Right.
You know, you think about like the elderly, you know, populations, how they have increases in, you know, falls and fractures. Well, because they lack their ability to control, you know, eccentric strength. So I think, you know, those, that's like the three dimensional. So it's movement, the strength and conditioning aspect, and then the clinical or the rehab side. And I think when you can really address those in programming at some point, you know, throughout the year, you just make a better athlete, right? And their you know, susceptibility to injury just goes down as a result.
Yeah. I mean, I think the two key things that you said there that I pulled out that I would want to emphasize is, you know, regardless of what your intent is or what your execution is, emphasizing the eccentric in any lift is always going to be important. That's a proper rep, right? 2 second positive, 4 second eccentric, you know. So I think emphasizing that regardless of where you're at in the year is always important just as a proper rep. But then I think playing around with the execution where you're, like you said, maybe the last four reps are only eccentric. You know, and you're gradually periodizing that to where it's not gonna have the same type of acute shock type of to your system when you're in the middle of, you know, like that year long competition type schedule or something. But I really appreciate that. You know, we talked a little bit about you being a strong man and you know, using non traditional elements. You know, and that's common. You know, you find it more and more in weight rooms, but you don't maybe always find it being utilized the right way or with poor technique or something. Talk a little bit about how you see strength coaches using the non-traditional elements into their normal program design.
I think that's really important, actually. I mean, I think traditionally, as coaches, as a strength and conditioning community, and we still have people like this, the powerlifting type of mindset where most of the programming was revolved around, you know, cleans and squats and benches, you know, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But you have to be able to really branch out and try different things. And I think one of the biggest reasons why people are afraid to try different things is because maybe they haven't really done it like themselves in order to really kind of feel what it's like to really do those things. And I think it's a good idea that when you program things and athletes training programs throughout the year, you should be able to do it, you know, yourself. You don't have to be world's strongest man or be an Olympic champion, be able to feel how it actually works. So that, again, you're better able to talk about that and relate it to the clients and athletes. We see tire flips, you know, quite a bit. I saw, like, you know, when you went to Notre Dame, they have, you know, kegs everywhere. You can use those for, you know, rows, for, you know, cleans, for presses, for carries. You know, obviously farmers walks, you know, good. So all these types of things are still pretty popular. One of the things I think that if you're using them, you know, for certain types of teams, it's in that particular situation, it's really more about versatility, you know, flexibility, as opposed to just using it for the load, right? And getting, you know, activating, you know, smaller muscle groups and stabilizers. But I think one of the key aspects of the non-traditional stuff that actually works really, really well is that when you're in a plane situation, you're not always moving in sagittal plane, you're not always moving in frontal or transverse. Like, you're in an odd loading patterns, right? So when you train with odd loading patterns, you have a better transferability to the stuff that you're actually, you know, really doing. So those are one of some of the fundamental reasons why, you know, they're really important. You know, plus it's fun, right? I mean, you can create team challenges, you know, with them. You can go distance. Things go for time. You can go for reps. Whatever it may be. And most people think, well, you know, you have to, you know, be world's strongest man to try this stuff. I mean, I've gotten, you know, some female clients and some female athletes and people in some of my previous classes to try them, and everybody loves it because it's just fun and it's just different. And that's what things are really about. Things are fun. They're different. It's exposing individuals to many different types of training methods out there. And I've always told people, when you can try different types of training methods, you don't have to, be super emotionally attached to it. You don't have to really, you know, marry those types of training methods, but just try them, because you're going to find sooner or later, you're going to be implementing them in your actual programs.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that variety is one of the, like, strength and conditioning principles that my program is based upon, and throwing, you know, tools in, non-traditional tools in, is a great way to add that variety. You just got to make sure that you add it in a way that it fits into the program. It's not in addition to, and that there is that progression, like you said. I mean, you have lighter kegs for your female athletes that they progress through, or, you know, being up at Notre Dame High School, there's lighter slosh pipes to the heavier, more advanced slosh pipes. And sometimes we see a big tire, so we go out and we get whatever the biggest tire we can possibly get is, and we expect our 12-year-old to do it, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's not going to happen. And I'm a big fan of, like, landmine exercises, you know, these days. It's another great, you know, tool for versatility. I've always been a big fan of accommodating resistance, obviously, with bands and chains, different specialty bars, you know, too, you know, just to, you know, do different things and, you know, activate, you know, different types of, you know, tissues and, you know, stabilizers and, you know, just be in kind of awkward, you know, situations. And because it comes down to, you know, adaptation, but also, you know, optimization as well. So, you know, and I get the idea of, you know, can you have too many tools in your toolbox? Yeah, you can have too many, but it's how you use them and when you use them and why that you're using them are really the key aspects.
Agreed. Well, man, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Best piece of coaching I've ever received. Just do things, you know, better and different than other people that you're around. You know, communicate with people, you know, be open-minded. You know, have values, have core values, you know, integrity, you know, character, you know, be loyal, be trustworthy. And so those would be, you know, some of my best coaching advices that I've had.
Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
So book recommendation, I would have to go with the latest book I've read, which is Gary Vaynerchuk's Crushing It, actually. So it came out back in like February. I read it in 3 days. And he's an awesome individual because he's really, you know, his platform is actually using social media to engage and, you know, platforms and reaching out to individuals and, you know, making your business and branding and things of that nature. So he, you know, he's got awesome YouTube videos. I would also give a plug to similar individual, Andy Frisella, who's the CEO of First Form Supplement Company, which is based out of St. Louis. Another big time, you know, entrepreneur. So he's got some really, both those guys got some really great stuff. And then, so yeah.
An app and a website?
An app and a website. If you're looking for a good like research app, I would go with what's called ReadQ. It's kind of like a yellow orange, you know, website. So basically you can type in any type of journal, name of a journal that you want to look at, and all the articles from those journals, you know, come up. And it's right there at your fingertips. You don't have to necessarily go online. If you want to get full text, you know, then you have to see, you know, search out the full text. But a great mobile app. Another app that if you want to use for, like, you know, videos and stuff would be Video Shop. That would be another great app. And then if you want to look at other things that are not coaching, you know, related, but have different categories, social media stuff or entrepreneurship, you know, definitely Flipboard for sure. And they have a lot of different types of categories and a lot of different articles. And Medium is also a good, you know, resource as well.
Yeah, I like both of those for sure. Well, man, like I said at the very beginning, I always appreciate guys that are in different spaces than your traditional norm. And I think unless people, it's the old adage of people understand what you're doing too much, then you're probably in the wrong space.
Right.
So being in that middle space of practitioner and academic and creating out, you know, helping carve out a new lane for coaches to go into, I think is awesome, man. And we've been working to try to set this episode up for a while, so it's great to
Right. On
share. I just appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. It was awesome, and I look forward to more in the future.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.